this murder in Florida after the shooting.
My friends, let's
no,
not get
the situation
confused about
occurred
semantics.
Before the shooting.
Right. Let's not get
that's the initial facts.
Friends, let's not get confused about semantics. Let me. What I'm going to do is I'm going to say goodnight. I appreciate your phone call, and I'll give you the assignment once we get off the air.
Thank you, sir.
All right, take care. And this is my point here. It's because I don't want to get embroiled in semantics, and our dear friend has found his voice. Now, we're talking about how damaged and broken everything is. We're talking about how sick and maligned the world has become. And we're talking about this. I mean, he was talking about race relations and people seeing each other as being different. I was talking about economic situations, possibilities for futures in Detroit, etc. You know, people are unhealthy. People are sick. You know, society is unhealthy and sick. Society is schizophrenic. It's going in a million different directions. There's all kinds of problems in our world, and it's hard to focus in on something because everyone's working so hard to survive or working so hard to not be in reality. I mean, you have two choices, essentially. I mean, there's the 1% that either worked or was given that position and doesn't have to concern themselves with a lot of the rat race. And then there's everyone else, right, who's working hard to survive or working hard to not be in reality. Does that make sense? You know, people working hard to live and put food on their family, etc., and people who are working hard to do everything they can to, you know, cloud their brain and prevent understanding of reality. And you can do that through drugs. You can do that through victimhood. There's all different. You don't need to be on drugs to be a victim. Trust me, I know. I've seen this before. There's all different types of ways to decide that it's somebody else's fault. And you can get lost in that. But what needs to happen is very true. What people need to do, and there needs to be value in this, and this is going to sound a little cheese, it's going to be a little hokey in this one, heal. People need to learn how to heal. And I don't mean get straight, taking antidepressants. I don't mean how to, you know, figure out how to, you know, budget things better so you can spend more money at the Family Dollar. I mean literally heal yourself. It's 2 minutes after the hour of two right here on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City. Literally heal yourself. My wife, who is working on getting a certification, I mean, she's already pretty amazing when it comes to the spiritual path and method of yoga. I'm not sure exactly how to identify that. And she has done a lot with her life, and she's trying to figure out what to do next. And it's something that she's done since she was a child. She's done this yoga thing since she was a child. And, you know, she was reading a book by a yogi, and it just kind of struck her. You know, there is a lot of power in this, and you can do this with people, and you can really, you know, change them. That there are positions, there are stretches, there are things that you can do with your body that all it requires is you to have space to stretch out. And you can heal yourself. And not just your tendons and ligaments, but you can heal your organs. You can heal your mind. All by stretching. And the amazing thing here is there's nothing external that you need. You don't need a pharmaceuticals company's drug. You know, you don't need a product from Walgreens. You know, you don't need to purchase and go to school or go talk to a doctor or do all these things that people think they need to do in a traditional way to heal, etc. You don't need to do that. All you need to have is a certain amount of knowledge with your body. So that's my... To my friend that we just spoke to, because I don't believe I got your name, sir. What your assignment should be to do is to figure out how to heal. And you're talking about trying to figure out how to heal some of the divides, how to unite. Same thing, same concept. I mean, you're talking about divisions and wanting to have unison, bring people together. I'm saying it's the same thing. We're disjointed. Figure out how to rejoin everything together. How to bring things together. And to do that, to figure out how to heal, to figure out how to reunite, you have to do that to yourself first. That's the hard part I think people, You know, like he's talking about the Trayvon Martin thing. People think a revolution is going to start with an explosion, right? There's going to be a bomb that goes off, and then all of a sudden, it's on, right? And then we're going down to the credit card companies, and we're blowing them up. Me and Tyler Durden, right? Is that the guy's name from the movie?
Fight Club?
Yeah. Sounds about right, doesn't it? But that's the point, though. People, there's going to be a loud explosion, and then after that loud, singular, explosive event, there's going to be difference. People are going to, it's going to be palpable. They're going to be able to smell it and feel it and taste it and touch it. But that's not how it works. Revolutions that happen that way last for very little or no time whatsoever. In fact, most revolutions have been miserable failures throughout the history of time.
Because a revolution is going in a circle. We need an evolution.
There you go, man. That's sweet. So figure out a way to unite. Figure out a way to heal. Figure out a way to change. And if you think that I'm not talking about what you were talking about, you're wrong, because I am. So I heard you loud and clear. I just don't want to get confused on semantics here.
Yeah, forgiveness and letting go are two huge steps into, recentering yourself for any change.
816-931-5534, that's 931-KKFI. You are on the radio.
All right, man. He was looking for an assignment.
Right? I gave him one.
You used to say, go find the others. Aren't we the others?
Yeah, well, that's. I think Ben was trying to say maybe to start with yourself first, and once you're in a healthy place, then go find the others.
No, I wasn't implying that Tony was not in a healthy place, and you don't have to be in a healthy place to go find the others. It's just that if you see, you know, you're looking at the world and you're seeing problems, chances are that you can find those same problems in your own life. And the only way to change what's going on in the world is to change something in your life to better yourself, because you can sit here and you can be, I guess it would ultimately be judgmental at the external world and go, there are problems here and there are problems there and there are problems over there, you know, and you can do, by doing that, you can avoid dealing with certain aspects of your own life that have problems. And maybe it's an emotional problem you have with other people. Maybe it's an emotional problem you have with yourself. Maybe it's a physical problem that you have, you know, with yourself. Maybe it's a health issue. Maybe it's a bad habit, a negative way of doing things.
We're all sick. We can't wait till we're healthy.
Well, but
to teach the next crew.
But the problem is, though, and like our friend was talking about earlier, is I firmly believe that children are born pure. I believe that they are little blank canvases, they are clean slates. I've said that to people a couple of times in just the last week, and they've really argued with me about that and said, no, that's not true. You know, people are not born pure. You know, they become pure later on in life if they go through a spiritual transformation, etc. And that's wrong. Children are born pure.
I agree.
They mirror... They reflect what they see in their lives. If they see a bunch of, you know, bad behavior, if they see a bunch of evil, if they see a bunch of kindness, if they see a bunch of good, they're going to reflect that. If they feel love all the time, they will project that. If they feel, you know, stress, anger, violence all the time, they will project that as well. It might not be immediate. You know, a little baby absorbs whatever it sees. It might still be gooing and cooing and smiling, but that will come out at some point. You know?
Yeah, you are a product of your environment.
You know,
I'm a product of my environment.
Right, exactly, precisely. So, you know, we talk about race relations in this country. I mean, there's no doubt that black people, white people, Mexican people, whoever, whatever type of people, are people more than they are anything else. They're the ethnic part, the racial part, is a prefix that's applied to people. So by default, we're much more similar than we are dissimilar. Black and white people are much more similar than, you know, people in Wales are, or something like that, or however, or people in inanimate objects are. I mean, we're much more similar. So the idea then becomes, as we learn all these divisions, and while we have found ourselves in a society that has become much more accepting of the differences of people's race, we're still not really close to finding ourselves able to be honest, communicate, and working together. I mean, it's still a great level of awkwardness between people who come from different racial backgrounds, and much more than race, it's a cultural background thing. Still have a problem because these are things that you learn when you're younger. You learn to be, you know, concerned or afraid or nervous or whatever, or prejudicial or bigoted about somebody else. And this is something that is done through society as people interact with each other, because, you know, starting with the way children act on the elementary school playground, and it primarily comes through the television set. I mean, that's the biggest one. That's the biggest reflection of our lives, is the TV and the way that we are programmed by it. And that's how people ultimately learn how to reflect themselves within society and understand themselves in the hierarchical caste system of our, you know, of this America, is by the television set.
So well, that's another thing. In general,
that's another thing. Well, right, except for this program.
Of course.
Except for this program.
To expand our minds, right?
So that's another assignment for you, sir. Get rid of your TV.
Amen. Crash it.
Unless the Royals end up in the playoffs and you can get your TV back and it'll be okay for a little while. But
you can hear it on the radio. You can hear that on the radio.
Yeah, you can hear that on the radio. But it'd be a lot more fun to watch on the TV.
Remember when DJs hated TV? I remember when I was a kid, DJs used to always talk trash on television. And
well,
so the
sure.
television stations own the radio station.
Yeah, and now there's no more DJs, are there?
No.
Think about that. Now all the DJs are gone.
Yeah, now it's Laszlo's MP3 player. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Is that really what he calls his program?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
But it's pretty much that's what it is.
Right. You know, and it's, you know, and Laszlo's friends talking about how awkward it was to get raped in the locker room at, you know, in high school. Like, yeah, every day I get raped. One day it was by a dude, the next day it was by pickles. It was really hard being in high school.
Yeah, I
would say. And Laszlo's like,
school,
Laszlo's
so
73.
I got no there,
still talking about. Still talking about high school. I never listened to the program.
I don't either. You're the only radio station I listen to, Ben.
Cool, man.
And I'm not trying to gratify you, buddy.
No, I feel really gratified.
Good, good. Because you got something great going on here, man.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. But we appreciate your recall, Kitch, and we'll talk to you again in the future.
Man, I'm so not done. I always get so ADD with you.
All right. Well, I'm sure you'll call us back again.
I got to crash, man. It's getting late on me.
Right,
but
well, guy's
God
crash.
Bless your show, buddy.
Yeah, God bless America. You're a great American.
Ditto.
You ever listen to that guy?
Not on purpose.
I'm Benjamin of Paragon Radio, and I'm a great American. You're a great American. Jake, you're a great American.
Hallelujah.
Glory, glory, hallelujah. Shall we sing patriotic songs? Glory, glory, hallelujah. All right, 13 minutes after 2. People were calling in earlier. We can still talk about minimum wage if you want. 816-931-5534. 931-KKFI. We could talk about the going rate for a used washing machine. You know, I'm a firm believer in reusing stuff. It's a good idea. 816-931-5534. ParagonRadio@gmail.com. And just so you know, there used to be things called blogs out there before Facebook and Twitter, and I still have one. I mean, blogs are, it's kind of going by the wayside, isn't it? I mean, Facebook is a blog, essentially.
Correct.
With a bunch of automatic gadgets already installed on it.
Right. It's kind of limited in its scope. Not everybody on Facebook can see what you post.
It's
allegedly.
A social blog.
Right.
As opposed to a technical blog.
You have some say in who reads what you say. Whereas I think a...
Right. That would be one of the principal differences. Yeah, but, blogs are important things, I think, aren't they? I mean, some aspects of the Internet are awfully important, and you should enjoy it while it's still here. You know, I read an article, and it's actually posted on my blog, Jake, about, you know, this NSA. You know, this NSA spying scandal, this Edward Snowden, this guy's finally got his Russian documents. He's somewhere in Siberia right now. Who knows where this guy is?
He's snowed in.
I told you that.
I know.
Hilarious, huh?
That's about as funny as Bernie Madoff with all the money and General Petraeus.
Yeah, right, right. So, you have to, I was trying to figure this out, and it makes perfect sense why this guy first went to China and then went to Russia. Because, even though, you're right, this guy is a state secret leaker, dissident whistleblower, traitor type, whatever you want to call him. Now, why would he go to China, which is not an open society, and then why would he go to Russia, which is also not an open society? Maybe Russia's more open than it used to be, but it's certainly not open right now. Why would he do that? And then you get to thinking, you're like, right. You know, if he were to go to a Latin American country and get asylum, don't you think that SEAL Team 6 would just bust in there and if they wanted to? Or maybe they might send like SEAL Team 3 or something like that. You know, if the American government really wanted to go get the guy, because didn't they ground the Bolivian president's plane as he was leaving somewhere in Europe? You know, they tried to say that there was an issue with some of the cargo or something. Speculation was that they were looking for Edward Snowden on the president of Bolivia's plane, because Bolivia would be one of those places where you could go. And trust me, I would much rather go to Bolivia than Russia. There's no doubt about that. Get all high in those Andes Mountains, you know what I'm saying?
The marching powder.
They have a lot of fun stuff to do down there in Bolivia. But the point being is that if you go to China, you can't, or you go to Russia, you can't really send SEAL Team 6 to go recover this guy that America wants to prosecute, right? You can't really do that. It's kind of genius to go to Russia when you think about it, because Russia's going to grant him asylum. Because they're not going to extradite him to America, because that's the game, right? Russia's not going to go, oh, of course, America, we're going to do whatever you want. They're going to play the game. And, you know, we read it last week. Did you see that letter that Attorney General Holder sent to his Russian counterpart, or the director of the Russian Migration Services or something like that?
I did not.
Well, where he's promising not to torture him. We won't torture him. We're not going to kill him. In America, you get a trial by a jury. You get a lawyer. You get to face your accuser. You get to do all this other stuff. I mean, basically spelling out all these enumerated rights that are contained within the Bill of Rights that don't really exist anymore. But he was trying to tell the Russian guy that they do. But it's kind of funny when, you know, the Attorney General of the United States has to explain to a foreigner from a country that is not known for its openness or freedom that, yeah, we promise not to kill him. We promise not to torture him. Do you think anyone in Russia gives a crap about that?
No,
they don't at all. But anyway, the fact that we had to promise that we won't do that in light of the way we've been operating for the last, 12 years now? It's just kind of ironic a little bit, I think. But it's genius for him to go to Russia, because that means that Russia's going to accept him. They're not going to extradite him back to America. They're not going to, you know, do whatever the Americans want. They're going to play. That's their chess piece, you know, and they're going to play a game with it. They're going to use it for leverage. They're going to see what they can get out of it. And they were talking about how it's already created a new Cold War. I mean, did you see that Obama canceled his travel plans to Russia? Ooh. And from what I understand from inside sources, Vladimir Putin is going to be taken off the White House Christmas card list.
Oh, no.
Yep, that's going to happen.
Well, canceling the trip to Russia, I mean, that's a $10 million boon to the local economy to get all the beast motorcades through there.
I mean, just laughable, if you will. It's completely ridiculous. But then I got to thinking again, and I was trying to explain this to anyone that would listen. This NSA disclosure and WikiLeaks in general mean absolutely nothing. Nothing at all. Nothing whatsoever. But before we get into that, I should probably play some announcements, some information here on 90.1 FM. KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine are all illegal and destructive to our communities and families. Alcohol is legal and has a much greater impact on society than all of those other drugs. We talk with Jim Reddy of the Regulated Industries Department of KCMO and Martha Means of the Municipal Prosecutor's Office on Jaws of Justice Radio, 9 a.m. Monday, right after Democracy.
I'm Lynn Snyder and I love sing-alongs. My friends and I will host a community sing at KKFI's Winfield Warm-Up on Sunday, August 18th at IBEW Local 124. We'll have a long afternoon of live concerts by a dozen or so live acoustic bands, a community sing-along, Winfield-style jam sessions, day passes for the KKFI fundraiser, only $15. Schedule, ticket information, and directions at kkfi.org.
Two minutes after the hour of two right here on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio, and we were talking about a whole host of things, and now Mike's here. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
And Jake's still here. Jake has actually not put down his cell phone the whole time he's been here.
Not true.
You can tell I'm here.
You did go to the bathroom, I guess. But you probably put it down. Or maybe you didn't. I don't know.
No, I stayed in here.
People in their little listening devices. But it's funny, I was thinking as I was leaving here, you know, because I've been riding the bicycle a lot, and I take the elevator. I normally don't take the elevator when I come here because it's only one flight of stairs.
Right.
And, you know, when I was a child, my father instilled a great fear of elevators in me because every time we'd get on one, he'd start jumping up and down and going, whoa! I don't know what that deal was, but he would jump up and down as hard as he could and start going, whoa! And then one time...
feel it shake a little.
Right. And then one time he actually... I don't know if it was him or it was just time for the elevator to be out of commission, but we were stuck on the elevator for like 3 hours.
Oh, wow.
And he literally did that. He's like, whoa, jumping up and down, and then the elevator didn't work. But I was thinking, I was leaving here. You know, if I'm going down that elevator and it just gets stuck between floors... Now, I'm the guy without the cell phone. That means I'm going to be in there for a long time.
Yeah, till somebody else is looking for that thing. And
you know, exactly. Like, it's broken. I guess I'll just use the stairs. I'm like, no, help me.
Right.
Help me. I'd be in there for a long, long time.
That's why I never take that elevator. I always have this fear that I'm going to, like, you know, start a spot or something, run out to the car, or and then it's like there'll be dead air, and I'll be, like, stuck in the elevator, no one knowing what the hell's going on.
Right, exactly. Like, yeah, apparently Mike just left.
Right.
Yeah, what a jerk. He left his car in the parking lot, too.
Right.
Very interesting. His coffee was on the table up there. Very, very weird. He just left. All right, so we've been talking about several things tonight. We talked about the low-wage, minimum-wage protests that took place in Kansas City on Monday, Tuesday. Did you see they want people who work at fast food restaurants to make over $15 junior Frosties per hour?
Junior Frosties.
Did you see that?
They could sell them at a profit. I'm right. Just saying. Of course, that would flood the market.
Yeah.
I'm not an economist.
Or a Frosty artist.
Yeah, so there's that. And, you know, just the general dystopian nature of the future of so many of our young worker bees out there, where they really have the opportunity to sell drugs, go to for-profit prisons, or catch bullets.
Well, it's...
Do you have anything else?
It's very... I don't know. I was thinking about that when that whole thing was going on, the couple, I guess it's been a week now, how people apparently just walked off, like, off the job that day because they were out marching.
Except for?
Well, I know there were a lot of people out there that, well, except for the managers, is that what you're talking about?
It's another M-word.
It's another M-word.
Oh, at McDonald's? They didn't?
No.
I missed it.
Mexicans.
Oh, right. They were like...
No, trust me. They had a big chunk of that protest was in Gillen Park, and I walked around looking, because I'm not stupid. I understand how it works. I was looking for our folks from south of the border.
Right.
And I, you know...
We're not trying to stir that trouble.
I mean, I'm pretty sure everyone still got their cheeseburgers that day.
Well, it was interesting to me that, like, one of the radio interviews that I heard... Or may have even... I don't think it was TV, because I don't think TV played it at all. But was one of the managers, they were asking, and I thought, man, she may not have a job tomorrow. Because she was like, $15, that's way too much. They should probably make like $11 or $12 an hour minimum. And I was just like, I'm sure that wasn't the company line.
Oh, probably not. No.
She was kind of...
You know why she said $15 an hour is way too much for the little worker bees to make?
More than she makes.
And she's like, I make $13.50 an hour.
Right.
That would be ridiculous.
And that's that reality of it.
That's just the nature of it. I mean, that's why they say, you know, when America reinvented itself as a service-based economy, and this is the end result of that, is it not? Because... What would be the effect, I mean, in reality, if McDonald's had to raise its prices because it was now paying its employees $15 an hour, which somebody from the Kansas business schools or something like that, was it K-State or KU? Or
KU.
It said that it would raise the price of...
Yeah, a value meal would...
Like 60 or 80 cents, which doesn't seem like that much, but then somebody was... Well, he's not taking into account the nature of the franchise... How, you know, you have individual owners who purchase the products, and there's going to be a whole bunch of other dynamics here.
Right.
But essentially, if you mess up the price of the extra value meals and the dollar menu, people are going to stop eating as much.
Right.
How many people out there literally depend upon that stuff for survival?
That's
scary.
It's a scary thought, but it is.
I mean, it's certainly a
reality,
step. It's
yeah.
A step above the sun-baked clay cakes that they enjoy in Haiti. There's more sustenance. I'm not joking about that. That's a real thing that folks, I mean, you know, folks eat clay in Haiti because it's better than going crazy with hunger pains.
Right.
It goes through your body. It's something in your stomach and your intestines. So you
not
don't,
a whole lot of nutritional value,
no,
but at least
you can't digest it. You can't do anything. There's nothing.
Placeholder.
A lot of fiber,
yeah.
But that's about it. Now, placeholder, right. And that's, I mean, no doubt. I mean, this idea that you might be better off starving to death than eating McDonald's your whole life and then getting all kinds of diseases that you can't afford to get the treatments for and then, you know, dying a horrible, miserable, pharmaceutical-induced death or something like that. Right? There's that to look forward to as well. But then didn't we talk about something more positive after that, Jake?
Healing.
Oh, yeah, healing. And yoga and stuff. Yeah.
I caught a little bit of you talking about the yoga and the healing and that. And my experiences with yoga, breathing, self-reparation of the body.
Right.
Is, like, that's spot on. But it's one of those things where it takes patience. And that's part of, like, what sells the pharmacological solutions,
oh, yeah,
right? It's like, what? You want to wait? We can give you a pill. You'll feel better now, and you'll get better whenever you get better. Or you'll get used to where you are, and then we'll sustain you with these pills. Which reminds me, I left my pills. But I was, where was it? Larry Miller? You know who he is, the comedian? He was on Bill Maher's show.
I'm not familiar with him.
I guess it was
Jake.
A couple days ago.
Larry Miller?
You'd know him. I mean, he was on Bill Maher's first ever episode of Politically Incorrect like 25 years ago. So, I mean, he's an old school comedian. You'd know him if you've seen him. But that's neither here nor there.
Has Politically Incorrect been on for 25 years?
Yes. Yes, isn't that crazy?
Jesus Christ.
And then I think back, I'm like, wow, yeah, I remember that. And I didn't realize Jerry Seinfeld was on the first episode, too, which is kind of funny because it was like a tribute to this Larry Miller guy that he was showing this clip, but then most of the clip was about Jerry Seinfeld kind of, I don't know, cashing in on that or something. I don't know, whatever. But however, Larry Miller had this accident about a year ago where he had this freak fall that cracked his skull open, and he was in this state where they basically told his wife that what they, and it kind of weirded me out that this is what they do, right? It's like they take a piece of his, they basically opened his skull up and kind of froze it while he was in this induced coma.
Froze his skull?
Yeah,
or his brain?
Like this piece of his skull to make it ready to go back in, basically, if and when his brain or his body would come back into, you know, come back into healing. And that's what happens, is it's like they're like, we don't know, he's either going to get better or he's not. I mean, there's this point where your body is constantly in this regenerative state. You know what I'm saying? I don't know if I'm coming across as clearly as I'd like to, but hell, it's 2:30 in the morning. How, at a point, like you were talking about with the yoga, the breathing, not having to go to the doctor for all of these things, but that if you breathe, if you just chill and relax, I've been amazed to find many times when I do go to the doctor, it's not that they do something, that they just tell you, relax, it'll come back. Like, I mean, when I scratched my cornea in my eye, I was like, oh, God. Oh, God, they're going to have to, like, how much is an eye transplant? How does this work? I don't even know.
You don't get a new one.
And then I go to the doctor, and he's like, put a piece of gauze over my eye and said, don't touch it, leave it alone. You'll be all right in 2 or 3 days.
Right.
Because your body just starts. I mean, and I look at cuts because I'm the kind of freak that walks around looking at wonderment at things that are normal. But like when I see a cut, it's just amazing to me to see how quickly it just starts. The body just starts going like,
sure,
all right, we're coming back together. This is not the state that we're supposed to be in, so let's get it right. And to me, that's been my experience with yoga, and that is like, okay, breathe, stretch it back out. We were talking, I don't want to get into your personal medical history or whatever, but we were talking about that injury that you were talking about, and then you could feel it popping back into place. And I remember doing that Bikram yoga.
The hot yoga?
That's some serious stuff there. But it helps, that heat, because...
You get loosened up.
Yeah, it helps you to get that... to that place where somebody else spent 20 years getting there, you know what I mean? Where they can just do that stretching.
Oh, right.
But, no, but it's... It seems to me like that's the solution, is to let our bodies...
And I'm sure that's the same thing for society in general as well. If we were to let things happen naturally, but I don't think that that's the way things actually operate. I think there's a lot of control that takes place where, you know, we expect governments to act as surgeons. You know, I knew this guy is from Mexico, and he was convinced that he had something wrong with his belly, and he didn't speak English all that well. But he'd tell me about it, and he was like, yeah, I need to take some time off of work so I can go get it cut out. And he was just convinced that there was something inside of his stomach that needed to get cut out. And then he would just go to the doctor one day and then be like, oh, you need to have that cut out? Sure, come on back tomorrow, amigo, and we'll cut it out, and you'll be back to work next week. You know, and I'm just like, that's the last thing you want to have happen.
Right.
To have them open you up and cut something out of you. Jesus Christ. I mean, there's kind of a notion that I think some people have. It's like, oh, yeah. If you go get surgery, then they cut you open, they heal you back up, and everything's going to be okay. But that's not really how it works. You have surgery, and that's an extremely invasive thing that, you know, your body might not ever come back completely from.
Right.
You know, because
and
the doctor might leave his wristwatch inside of you.
Well, and with the techniques that they use now, it seems less invasive. My wife had some work done on her knee, and, you know, they were talking about how what they used to do was like cut this open and
display
it all out there and reconstruct. Now they have these little microfibers they can put in there, and it's almost like using a little joystick to do something. So it's not as invasive or seemingly as invasive, but still, you're cutting out cartilage here and a little piece of bone there, and then you've got a whole new set of problems, because while now you can better extend that knee or whatever, because there's this disruption in how the cartilage is and all that stuff, she's got other issues that will continue to be a problem.
Right.
Until in 5 or 10 years they say, well, now we'll go back in and we'll cut that little piece out.
Sure.
Oh, it'll be all better for another fight. I mean, that's literally what happened to my father-in-law. He had something done, I'm trying to remember what it was, some kind of skin cancer type of deal that he had fixed, and he said they told him when he got it done originally, like 15 years ago or something, that it's okay, you probably won't. This is not the actual fix, but it won't be a problem for you for another 15 or 20 years. You'll probably be dead by then. I mean, like, almost literally that was their take on it, was like, this will get you through the rest of your life. But they know going in that the stuff that they do doesn't necessarily work. That makes sense.
No, well, it shouldn't, but it does. But I think this is a broader example of, you know, so the surgery is the government. You know, the surgeon is the government deciding it's going to, you know, people are just going, come on, government, come do something. You know, or the way, you know, subsidized corporations operate as well. It's just that if people are left up to their own devices and there isn't a certain amount of manipulation and control, then I think things can actually be solved. And I think a lot of the problems, see, and that's it. So many of the problems of society are very simple ones. And this is universal. You know, the people in Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza Strip, they want to have food. They want to have clothing, they want to have shelter, they want to have opportunity, and I'm pretty sure it's the same thing on the other side of the big wall that Israel constructed for the majority of those people. Now you have people, you have the terrorists on the Palestinian side, and you have the terrorists on the Israeli side who are creating conflict because neither one of them is willing to give in to the reality of their situation, and neither one of them are going anywhere. But primarily speaking, you know, I'm sure the majority of people are just like, we just kind of want to live in peace and be able to move around and be able to do what we want to do. And you can say, well, the Israelis are on top in that situation, which is probably true. But nevertheless, there's probably more, you know, unanimity within the peoples than there is, you know, division within
right.
them. And this is true everywhere, and it's just, you know, why is Detroit or, you know, other, you know, parts of this city, you know, a dystopian, you know, bizarro world of what things might have been. I mean, I've not been to Detroit. I've not seen how the city has fallen apart, but I've been to the East Bottoms, you know, and it's like that down there. I mean, there's parts of the East Bottoms that you can see were old and industrial and now abandoned. You know, old churches, old neighborhoods that are just
kind of
gone.
That's why what we have now is this revitalization that's happening down there. Or, no, that's the East Bottoms, not the West Bottoms. So they're trying that now. There's some folks moving in over there.
Yeah, and I mean,
that's the way the West Bottoms was 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah, and it was just hookers and haunted houses.
Right.
And now it's hookers, haunted houses, and art galleries.
Well, they chased the hookers out of it.
Did they?
Well, at least that's what the lady said.
I don't visit as much as I used to.
In the little story about their revitalization, that I like, this used to be a lot tougher. They're demanding roads down there because
they didn't pay for
them. They want business. Yeah, right. They want people to come there. It was like such a neglected area, and they were saying, you know, we want the city services because we're tired of chasing the hookers off ourselves. That was basically
right
what she said.
But I mean, things come back, I guess, sometimes. I mean, to a certain degree, if they're given the opportunity. But, you know, things like Detroit are not going to come back because of the manipulation that happened.
Right.
You know, and, hey, I don't think anyone really believed what they said about NAFTA and globalization when it was taking place, that it was going to be good for the American worker to compete with Chinese slaves. I don't think that anyone ever really thought that was a good idea. Or that things were going to ultimately get better. And they didn't. But here we are. And the solutions to it, I mean, they're real difficult. Because unless you want to get highly specialized doing something that's probably soul-sucking, you know, to be part of the service economy, I mean, what are you going to do? Sell drugs, go to prison, or catch bullets. Or, you know, have another soul-sucking job to a certain degree. And it's this idea of re-evaluating the way we perceive ourselves and the way we understand making a living.
No, that's absolutely the order of the day. I mean, that is what we need to do, is re-evaluate all that. But I don't know that we are. I mean, that's the sad reality of it, is that we are too easily, you know, coaxed into this feeling of, well, like you said, the government as a surgeon or whatever. That
we want these quick fixes. It's like the, you know, in Cleaver's address to the people striking for more money, you know, is that if McDonald's workers are paid $15 an hour, it'll be a great boon to the economy. That then all of a sudden, these McDonald's workers who are making $15 an hour will be able to go out and stimulate the economy by purchasing more stuff. But is that true? I don't think that's actually how economics work.
Well, they'd certainly have a lot more money, and then prices would start going up.
Well, right.
Across the board.
Sure. I think that's part of it as well. You know, I mean, what, you know, when we're really talking about is the inability of our currency to purchase anything of value within reason anymore.
Right, or such an astute politician, Reverend Dr. Deuce, can't look at that issue and also discuss the other end of it, the inflation. Forget $15 an hour. Like we're stating, if the prices are just going to go up and they're going to print more Federal Reserve notes, you know, at some point, $90 an hour is not going to be enough.
Well, and it's so funny how they do address it, or they mention it without addressing it, right? Because, like, I think part of what he said in that speech, too, was like, you know that, you know, you make the same amount of money as in 1962 or something, you know. He looks at the inflationary pressures on wages and says that the $8 an hour that you make now is the same as the $2 an hour that someone made in 1967, 68, or whatever. So he readily points out that there's this inflationary effect, but then just walks away from that without going the next step, like you said.
Right. And if these fast food workers and the caller who wanted an assignment, if that would be the focus of, you know, a lot of these occupying Wall Street while usury is so out of control, you know, it's don't hate the player, hate the game.
Right.
Type mentality.
Let's talk about the game.
More right. People need to, even address the fact that, you know, $7 an hour doesn't buy you food and shelter and clothing, you know, especially if you have children.
Right. And I like when you use words like that, like usury, because people don't associate that, because, you know, a good hardcore Christian, Judeo-Christian, reading through their Bible, you know, may not even see that it's right there, that the whole interest-based economy that we have, right, is like kind of anti-Judeo-Christian, but we don't.
I thought it was it was about Muslims.
Well, Muslims are hold the same types of outlooks on that, but I mean,
I'm pretty sure the Muslims still keep that real, though. In the Middle East, you're not. I mean, from what I understand, when Western banks have gone into Middle Eastern countries, they have to operate differently. You're
right.
Allowed to charge fees on loans. But you can't charge interest. You can't have compounding interest.
Especially
right.
On money that's not yours. I think there's...
But you have like a duty if you do have money to help other people who don't have money. Not give it to them.
Right.
But, you know, loan it to them. But you have like a responsibility.
Yeah, wisely for actual investment. Not, you know, derivatives. That are
right.
Investments on investments on investments on investments on a scam. On a phony spreadsheet.
But, you know, that's really, you know, confidence, the con game. I mean, that's really how you make big money in America. And if you want to be a part of that, then, you know, you go to school and you end up on Wall Street or whatever it is. I mean, it's treachery to a certain degree. It's part of the game that gets played.
Absolutely.
Right, well, Fido, or fidelity, that's the Latin word for, you know, being true and honest, and confidence is the etymology of that, is the opposite of honest. I mean, you're just...
Well, con would be with.
A pro would be.
Pro would be for.
Con would be against.
No, con would be with.
Don't let me get picked my phone back up. I finally set it down.
All right, well. And anti would be
against. With fidelity, that's what confidence is?
With, a con game, a confidence game, or a con, is based upon getting somebody to trust you.
Right.
And then you screw them over.
Right.
Right? Trust us. A con game. Consumer confidence.
Right.
The conning out the consumer, it's a bit, yay. So much fun to talk about this stuff. Let's talk about the Domain Awareness Center that they're installing in Oakland.
The Domain Awareness Center?
Yeah, the Domain Awareness Center. Instead of having the police department in Oakland, they're going to have the Domain Awareness Center. This is coming everywhere, too, by the way, folks.
Is this a computerized...
It is. You know, to dovetail with this, in New York, they're in the process of hearing, you know, the big lawsuit against the police for their stop and frisk policies.
Right.
You know, so in New York City, there's pressure put on the police to appear as though they're doing something, and the activity that the police have given themselves to appear as though they're doing something, it's harassing minorities and
right.
other people who look like they deserve harassment from the police by stopping and frisking them. And in the course of the court, the court action, the trial, I should say, the judge suggested, have we not thought about putting police cameras on police officers who are walking beats? So we have cameras on cop cars.
Right.
Should we have cameras on cops? I just, okay. You know, when a cop pulls somebody over, that's when the camera turns on, right?
Right.
If a cop is stopping and frisking somebody, or stopping to harass somebody, would the cop then have, you know, be like, okay, I'm going to stop and harass this guy, I'll turn my camera on. You know, he's not going to have sirens or some sort of switch that he...
Right.
So maybe the camera would be recording all the time, just to make sure that it records everything.
Probably.
And if you're recording all the time, you might as well interface
store
that.
Store it somewhere.
Yeah, and interface it within, you know, license plate scanner readers and various other information that you might be able to gather. Might as well, right? Because that's the direction we're going. Because Kansas City has that. Kansas City has, there's a cop car in every single precinct with a license plate, or not precinct.
Picking up 7,000
what do they call them?
Plates a day?
Center, every single patrol has.
Oh, yeah, patrol divisions.
Because I don't think they have precincts anymore. Right? Precinct would be an antiquated term for somewhere like Kansas City. I mean, you have.
Right, as Kansas City policing evolved, they probably used different. It's kind of like counties and parishes. And
well, no, but they just don't have the smaller subdivision,
I believe.
It's just the major patrols or whatever. So, you know, for every single patrol, they have license plate scanner readers. They're just scanning away. And that, you know, I mean, come on, the Department of Homeland Security is giving out federal grants right and left, like hotcakes. So every locality can have these. And then, of course, I mean, the next step will be to interface license plate scanner readers and just straight-up guilt scanning readers with drones. Like, yo, man, that dude waiting for the bus, he looked guilty.
All right.
Go get him.
Yeah, that whole passive policing thing is kind of...
But that's the future, and that's what's happening right now, because places like Oakland, they can't afford to pay their police. They can't afford to pay their police a salary, give them benefits, or a pension.
Pensions, yeah.
So it's much easier to have a domain awareness center. Now, it starts out because Oakland is like the second or third busiest port on the West Coast, probably the second behind L.A., and I think it's the fifth busiest port in America. So you have these, you know, cameras that are interfaced within the port system. But then the idea is that you just interface that along with cameras everywhere. You have,
right.
You know, they had a city council meeting where a lot of people who showed up were outraged at the idea of doing this, having this interface. So the Domain Awareness Center is essentially would be a 24/7 command center where you have cameras, license plate scanners, and shot spotters, which are microphones set up throughout the city to listen for gunshots and possibly other things.
Not conversations.
Maybe really loud conversations that sound like machine gun fire or something
like
that.
Or disruptive conversations.
Yes, disruptive conversations.
Subversive?
Yes. How about we have a strike? Oh, hey, it heard that.
Strike it up.
That it heard. That it can hear very well.
But then you are integrating all this within, I'm sure, computers, and then you have to have a human being somewhere, right?
The on switch.
High above, you know, the base level of having all these cameras. And it was kind of, you know, bizarro in that the city council meeting they had in Oakland about this, where they were discussing it, the city council people weren't even sure how many cameras they had already operational in the city. Which is one of those things, you know. We know we have a lot. How many do you have? Well, we got 130, 140 cameras, something like that. And one of the people who was against the Domain Awareness Center was saying that you don't get to have authority over us digitally if you don't know how many cameras there are. You have
right.
to at least know how many there are before you can have authority over us like that.
And they probably can't even get that information because it's classified at this point.
Well, I'm sure it's less of a matter of it being classified or more of a matter of the politicians who are in charge of the stuff being aware of the things that they are, in fact, in charge of.
Right. I had a traffic court judge on the Kansas side because I swear I didn't do it. It
always scares me.
And that intersection had cameras in it. And I asked that that be part of the proceedings that for, you know, discovery and if they have any evidence to prove me not guilty, innocent, that they're required to, you know, present it. And the judge told me in open court without whispering or anything that those were operated by the Department of Defense and she would have no way to access them anyway.
And this was like six, seven years ago now?
Yeah, it was post 9/11, probably 2004, 2005.
I'm always like to declare the Kansas Department of Defense. Or?
See, this is what I'm saying. See,
the COD.
You've told me this story a number of times, and I always grasp for some not quite nefarious meaning. Are we sure that they didn't say Homeland Defense?
She said Department of Defense.
Fatherland Security.
Maybe she just the Homeland Defense was new enough that
she was confused.
Left out Homeland. Not that that makes me feel any better.
Maybe she was just like, I'm gonna really jack with this guy.
Right.
No, that, she had my jacket. And she was she, flipping through it.
Conspiracy theory guy. Okay, here we go.
That's
all right,
we
can't give you that. The Illuminati. You have to have an Illuminati.
Yeah, the
badge.
Illuminati run these cameras. And you need to have an Illuminati password and handshake.
Which I had prepared with me at that proceeding.
How funny.
No, but that's, yeah, you know, whether it's Oakland or here, just like the private prison, like the private prison system, there's some contractor somewhere that's not technically a government agency that.
Right.
Installs and operates these, and I think the chain of command is broken and need-to-know basises are not known. And, yeah, it's, you know, these fusion centers aren't under the jurisdiction of a traffic court judge or the Oakland City Council.
Right. It all gets...
Well, if they were aware of that.
Right, or if they cared.
Right, it's like a bubble. Like with so many different ways for them to get out. I mean, it's like
plausible deniability.
If you say you want it for a court, they go no, that's part of a defense thing. But then if you come in at it from a different angle, they'll be like no, that's not our department. That's their. You know what I mean? It's
right. There's the
so
Department
many.
Of Transportation. They're monitoring traffic. Or yeah, there's a million ways to deny
right.
it.
Well, it's like I was. Watching the Bill Maher show, actually this afternoon, and they were talking about the Homeland Defense. I guess, like, the top echelon of that department is vacant. Like the secretary, everybody's quit, basically. It's like they're whatever. But the discussion, somebody raised the point about why don't we just get rid of it? And Barney Frank was there, and he's like, "Well, you gotta have these.
It's time.
These people, you know, the NTSB and the." And he named off a couple organizations, and I was like, "But those, they were there. We had the TSA before the Homeland Defense. I mean, before September 11th, we had, you know, bags inspected and whatnot. We just didn't do it the way that we do it now. And not that the way we do it now is." The right way, it's that...
There was not a Simon Says component involved
right.
with. Simon Says, take off your shoes.
We really have to reconsider what we've done in the wake of September 11th. I mean, it's been...
But what about the fact that they had the most credible threat since 9/11
this weekend?
In regards to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen... They shut down the embassies on a Sunday, which just seems like, let's give the guys at the embassy a day off. Are embassies open on Sundays?
You know, this came up once before. In other countries, Sunday is like Monday.
Yeah, the Sabbath is literally Saturday.
Right.
A lot of the Orthodox...
And you want to talk about conspiracies. get into it with some Seventh-day kind of folks.
The Adventists.
The
it's not just the Adventists.